The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey everybody, welcome to Typology. Ian Cron here, coming to you from Typology Studios in the 12 South neighborhood of Nashville, Tennessee. I'm joined by my confrere, my friend, my dear, dear brother, Anthony Skinner.
Ian Cron, good to see you today. We were together last night.
We were.
Let's talk about that.
Okay, we went, this was my first really kind of party since COVID.
Since COVID, yep.
And there was, it was packed.
It was a great reentry, wasn't it?
It was. It was for our dear friend, Katie Williams. Her husband, Randy, threw a party for her 40th birthday. And it was really an assemblage of people, wasn't it?
Oh.
Everybody from Kep Mo.
Yeah.
The great artist Kep Mo to four or five people who were there who've all been on the show before.
Former guests.
Bart Millard was on the show from Mercy Me and Jill Phillips. And, of course, Randy and Katie have been on the show.
Dolly showed up.
Dolly showed up. That was something, wasn't it? I mean, this. Oh, all right, let's just get this. Let's just dial this in a little bit more for people. A Dolly impersonator showed up and, like, just sang for Katie and humiliated her for a good 20 minutes.
Yeah. Randy joined in.
That's right.
They did the Kenny Rogers duet.
They did, and the whole room sang Islands in the Stream.
Katie is on the panel of sixes.
Yes.
Y'all should check that one out. Randy is on the panel of nines.
Awesome.
That one's great as well.
Yep.
Like you said, lots of former guests.
Bart was on. He's a six.
Yep.
Bart Millard. And also...
it's good to see him.
And there were a couple other people there, musicians. And I just love this town.
Yeah.
There's just so many interesting people.
Yeah.
So many interesting people. I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Have you seen a movie that you really love lately?
A couple things, I would say.
A couple?
Yeah, just watched Green Zone again for the second time and Broadchurch. Love that.
How about you? Well, I just saw Derek Del Gaudio's In and of Itself.
I haven't heard of this. Tell me about it.
It's actually was done originally as live theater.
Okay.
And it's taped in front of an audience.
Mm-hmm.
It is really extraordinary. It's all about identity. And it's so powerful.
Ooh, I have to see this.
Yeah, In and of Itself. And you got to watch it in one sitting. You can't break it up.
Did you watch it online or did you go somewhere?
It's streaming. I think it may be on Hulu.
Okay.
Something like that. Hey, and I got one more for you.
I'm doing that, yeah?
All right. Have you seen the show F1?
Yes.
About Formula One racing?
Yes.
Can I just tell you something? I have absolutely zero interest in cars. I could not stop watching it.
Yeah, it's killer.
I could not. That whole universe.
It's amazing.
Now, speaking of films.
Yeah. We have another exciting announcement.
We do. It's not as interesting as In and of Itself or F1. However.
Oh.
It's still pretty good.
Yeah.
For the next few days, folks can get my Enneagram course, True You, A Deeper Exploration of Your Enneagram Type, Anthony.
Yes.
For just $97. $97.
That is amazing.
Right. If they sign up before Monday night, June 14th, they're not only going to get the discount.
But there's two amazing bonuses. Tell us about those.
Right. Well, the first one is you'll get instant access to a recorded Q&A session hosted by moi on your Enneagram type. During which I answer all kinds of questions from folks on how to use the Enneagram as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then number two, this is great. Folks will get a free 1 month trial to my brand new membership experience.
Okay. This is packed too. This is packed with really good stuff.
Right. So if you're a member of our subscription service, right, you get an exclusive podcast episode. You get a curated newsletter from me. And best of all, this is the thing I love most, is you get an invitation to our live town hall Q&A session with me and the other folks who are part of the membership subscription community. It's really great.
People get to come on, ask you questions. Sometimes other people jump in and they get to weigh in with a question someone else asked. So all you have to do is go to typologyinstitute.com/true you, all one word, to sign up.
That's right. And it's I'm proud of the film. right? It ain't in and of itself, but it's still pretty good.
You're selling yourself short. This is great.
Well, anyway, again, go to typologyinstitute.com/trueyou now to sign up.
All right, so let's talk about our guest today.
Woo, this was a great conversation. This is a guy, his name is Ryan Casey Waller. And I loved, and I mentioned this in the show, right? When I got his press kit, it says, Ryan Casey Waller is the pastor, quote unquote, the pastor who showed up drunk to church. And I thought, book him. Book him.
He's in.
We've got to get him on the show. He's my kind of guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, he has written a great new book that I've read. It's called Depression, Anxiety, and Other Things We Don't Want to Talk About. He's a therapist. He's an Episcopal priest. He has firsthand experience talking about mental illness and the struggles that so many folks have that, particularly in the church, we need to start getting comfortable talking about.
Yes, that's right.
He's articulate. He knows the Enneagram super well. He's an Enneagram 2. I just thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. It's filled with moving moments and also some pretty funny moments.
And Wendy, who is part of the Ian Cron team, she called me today freaking out over this interview. She was like, I love this interview with Ryan. She's a two as well.
Look, so. I mean, listen, how can you not love a guy, a pastor who showed up drunk to church?
Right.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's get online with the drunk vicar and see what he has to say to us. Ladies and gentlemen, my new friend, Ryan Casey Waller, author of the book, Depression, Anxiety, and Other Things We Don't Want to Talk About. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. So happy to be here.
You are an Enneagram 2. You're not only a psychotherapist, pastor, co-sufferer, you're also a lawyer. That is interesting to have both a lawyer and a priest on the line, isn't it?
Yeah, totally.
Wow. Fantastic. You studied at the University of Southern California, at Southern Methodist University. You're clearly a bright guy. I can't wait to jump into this book and how you're using your self-knowledge that gained from the Enneagram and now as a self-identified Enneagram 2, the helper, and how that has helped you on your journey. Okay, in just a couple of sentences, on the elevator pitch, give us the crux of the message of the new book.
The crux of the message is that mental health is health, and we all have it. And so we can ignore it, we can mistreat it, we can take care of it. No matter what, though, we can't deny that it exists. And for those that are in faith communities, for those who struggle with their mental health, I want them to know that it's not necessarily a faith issue. It's not necessarily a sin issue. It's a health issue. And that God has given us all manner of forms of healing. And those of us who are Christians, if we battle any kind of mental health issue, it is more than okay to raise our hand and say so and avail ourselves to the many resources that God has given us for our healing.
Oh, man, that sounds pretty good. Okay, there's always a story behind the story, brother. So what I want to know is, what was your particular experience that led to some journey of healing, it sounds like, that was the impulse behind writing the book?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so to back it up, when I was a kid, I think I battled depression and anxiety pretty much my entire life. It went unidentified, undiagnosed, even though I had parents who were very attentive. And when I would say things as a kid, like, hey, dad, I feel like the world is moving too fast, or I had real intense anxiety around school and sports, parents were very attentive. They'd ask me questions. They would be with me. They would talk to me. They would make me feel safe. But it was the 80s, and it wasn't just kind of, I think, the natural thing to do, at least not here down in Dallas, Texas, to take me off to a therapist. And so I struggled with these issues of depression and anxiety all the way until my early 30s, when I began to have panic attacks, just some really, really serious panic attacks, where I finally said, okay, enough is enough. I need to avail myself to some treatment. Got in to see a psychiatrist, began doing the work of psychotherapy, added in the mix of medication. And I had this moment not immediately, but a few months into it, where I was like, oh my goodness, I actually don't have to live this way. I didn't know that the pain that I was experiencing, these troubles, that there was treatment that could help dissipate these symptoms. And so I experienced sort of my own healing there. Well, fast forward a few years, I get myself into a place where I'm working in the church, pursuing another graduate degree, and I get myself just completely burned out and fail to continue to seek out the treatment that I need to keep myself in a healthy mental space. And I get to the point where I begin to use alcohol as my primary coping mechanism, which leads to this moment that I describe in the book where I go to church for a Sunday evening service and I'm completely intoxicated. And it's the most embarrassing, worst slash now looking back, maybe best moment of my life, because it was one of those moments where it's like, all right, something's really, really out of whack here. And you need to step back and seek a higher level of care, which is what I did. And it became sort of this great falling upward, to use, you know, Richard Rohr's language, moment for me, where I really suffered some serious humiliation and some recognizing that, look, what I'm doing and what I'm chasing, what I'm pursuing is not working anymore. And I've got a choice whether to either lean back into that and keep going or really spend some time figuring out who I am, what I want to be about, and how I can get healthy. And so that was the point for me, which I, you know, jumped into my own healing. But in between those two incidences of experiencing depression and anxiety the first time, and then having the big sort of breakdown, if you will, in between that, I had begun to pursue this counseling degree because I was realizing that there were so many people in faith communities like me who battled depression and anxiety, but were very weary of raising their hand and saying that that was the case and seeking out help because of the deep stigma. So now I'm very vocal about this and wanted to write the book to not only share my own story of suffering, but also because I want others to know they're not alone in this. And I want to battle that stigma that really is still there, particularly in the Christian community, about mental health and mental illness.
It's great. You know, this is a very timely message and one that's being picked up in a lot of segments of our world. I recently just listened to a podcast, if you haven't heard it, with Prince Harry and Dax Shepard. Did you hear that episode?
Man, I've heard bits and pieces of it. I love Dax's podcast, and I write about Prince Harry in the book when he, you know, first years ago kind of rose his hand and was able to say, like, look, I've battled with this. So, but I haven't heard that episode.
Yeah, check it out because it's really great. And some of what he talks about is what you're talking about, albeit from not from a faith perspective, but just from a societal perspective. And his own struggle with anxiety and depression and mental health issues as a result of growing up in just, you know, probably with the craziest family in the history of the world.
Well, Ian, I say that in the book. I'm like, look, if Prince Harry, right, who comes from like the most buttoned up family, seriously, like in the history of the world, is able to say, like, you know, any of us can suffer from this, and the reality is we've all got to tend to it, then who among us, right, can say, like, oh, that's not something we do in my family, or, right, that I can't, like, come on, this is the most rigid structure ever, and if this guy's willing to do it, right, we've all got to be able to take that lead as well, and not be above it.
All right, I just want to sort of weigh in at the risk of not wanting to be too self-referencing, but just to make maybe a qualification for our people. When I first got sober in 1987, directly following it, I fell into a 5-year depression. That also, which was not diagnosed correctly, it was diagnosed as a generalized anxiety disorder because a central feature of it was panic attacks. And, you know, back then, I think, you know, it was sort of the advent of new medications for depression right around that time. There was Prozac, the new SSRI, sort of class of medications. And they tried everything for 5 years. None of it worked. Sadly, that's also where I was first introduced to benzodiazepines like Xanax and Klonopin, which eventually ended me up in treatment years down the road after it. But because it went from being a prescribed medication to something else. So I have some kind of a background in it. And of course, in 1987, in the faith-based world, this was a conversation nobody wanted to have. And In fact, I can remember going to church, you just need to pray more. Mm-hmm. You know, you just need to be a better Christian, or there's something so broken about you that let's just not talk about it, you know. And I had to, you know, go find help in lots of other places, but I didn't find it in the church. That's for damn sure. And I, you know, it was a time of not only it was like what's called the second arrow. You have the first, you get shot first with the arrow of depression and anxiety, and then it's followed by the second arrow, which is being shamed by yourself and by your community for having depression and anxiety.
Right.
Right. I mean, you end up shot twice in the same wound.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I empathize, and that's why I'm excited about this book. Here we are all these decades later, and it's hard to believe that the church can be so, fail. I mean, the society fails in this regard, but, you know.
The church fails too. I appreciate you saying that. And here's what really kills me. Like, so you're describing that in the 80s. So back up just a couple of years, I'm in the Episcopal Church. And, you know, people would come to my office, and I know you're an Episcopal priest as well, and they would come in and they would describe to me, right, just the situations that they were in that were extreme. And I know what they were wanting, right? They were wanting to have someone to express it to. And what they were hoping from me, I think, was some sort of prayer or some sort of blessing that could come into the situation and offer some hope and some healing. And so often, though, what I would hear is I would say, you know, it sounds to me like you might be experiencing some depression, or it sounds to me like your anxiety maybe has risen to the level of being clinically significant, or tell me again how much you're drinking, you know? And I would say, I wonder, would you consider, speaking to a professional? Have you ever thought that? And instantaneously, what would so often happen is that a situation that they were describing as dire would all of a sudden not be that bad. They would say, no. You know, it's actually not that bad, Father. I just, you know, or they would say, you know, that's just not something we do in my family. Or no, I really think it's just that I'm not spending enough time, right, working on my relationship with God. Or there would be a few people that would say, oh, okay, yeah, well, do you have a referral list? Do you have somebody that I can call? And I would say, well, yeah, I do. You know, I've got multiple. Here you go. And then almost inevitably, they returned to my office, you know, weeks or months later, and the same issue would still be there. And I would ask, well, hey, did you go and call, you know, so-and-so? And almost 100% of the time, the answer would be, no, you know, I didn't. And it just happened over and over again. I thought, oh, my goodness, we are just still in this place where people are not getting the help they need in the church, because there's such a strong narrative that's exactly the narrative you got in the 80s, where it's like, man, you just need to read your Bible more, or you need to get down on your knees. And it's like, this is the exact opposite, I think, of what Jesus has in mind for healing for these kinds of issues. So.
Well, we're going to circle now to the Enneagram, but before we do, I had a moment that was so interesting. This is years ago, but had a fella back when I was more active in parish life, and he came to see me, and he struggled with taking medication for depression, and he needed it. I mean, this was not somebody that someone just threw 20 milligrams of Prozac at because, you know, they were lazy. You know, the therapist was lazy, really needed it. And I said to him at one point, you know, every time you have to take medication in the morning, you know, I want you to hold the tablet in your hand and think of it as Eucharist.
Mm.
Because in that pill is thousands of years of believers who had prayed for a solution.
Mm. That's beautiful.
And it was unavailable to them at the time. and you are holding the sum of those members of the communion of saints who prayed for healing, you are holding an aid, maybe not the complete solution, but an aid to your own healing. And that sort of changed his mind about medication. And
that's beautiful.
Yeah, it's one of four moments when I said the right thing in my life. Anyway, you're an Enneagram 2, and I was so fascinated because kind of your bottom out, right, is here you are, you're in a church, you're working your ass off, no doubt, like most pastors do. You have burned out, which sounds like a common Enneagram 2 journey, on helping other people. I guess that's part of it, right? And you turn to alcohol. I would say that in my experience, the numbers that have sort of the biggest proclivity to addictions, although all nine are certainly capable of being addicts, twos, fours, sevens, eights, and nines. For twos, I'll leave it up to you. But so was your being an Enneagram 2, perhaps not aware of it at the time, was it contributing to the journey that you were on of struggling with mental health, maybe not getting the help that you needed, and turning to alcohol as a self-medicating or self-treatment plan that wasn't working out for you?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that understanding now, using the two, right, as the lens for what was going on there, I absolutely, really, really enjoy other people needing me desperately, right? And so being able to provide that and being needed, I need it. That's where I'm like finding, self-worth. And so like I have the predisposition to the anxiety and the depression. But I think what was really beginning to happen was in my mind, I was going above and beyond. I was striving like nobody's business, right? To do what I thought was really helpful for not only the people I was serving, but my family, the community, trying to kind of strive on all these different levels. And what I didn't realize at the time is that I wasn't being appreciated in the way that I felt like I should be appreciated. And I had anger about it. And I didn't deal with the anger. And what the alcohol was doing for me, as I reflected on it, is that I would get to the end of the day and I would feel burned out and I would feel so freaking frustrated. And I didn't know what to do with the anger. So instead of like lashing out about it, I thought, well, when I drink a little bit, I'm a little less angry, right? And so instead of trying to understand at the time, and I couldn't see it at the time, that it was that I needed to express my need for appreciation, but I was unable to identify my need, which is why this too really helps me make sense of that. I was just sort of stuffing it down until eventually, as anyone who knows, whether you're battle alcohol for 30 years or 2 years or your whole life, like you abuse a substance, like it's going to come out sideways at some point. Mm-hmm. Unless it obviously did for me. But the two, looking at my life in that way, helped me understand that kind of what I thought was so like righteous, I guess, like this desire, like to help, mostly, maybe not entirely, but a big part of that was me just trying to be loved and be accepted and have self-worth. I need these people to need me. And not just that, I need them to tell me and show me with the same amount of passion, right, that I'm helping them. I need that reciprocated. And that wasn't happening. And I was mad about it.
But what I love about what you said again is you know, and I've said this to other guests before when I see it, right, which is, man, self-awareness really works. Self-knowledge really, really works. The Enneagram is not a perfect roadmap for exhaustive self-knowledge, but it's a useful tool that might begin you on a journey toward increased self-awareness of what some of the underlying issues are that are driving anxiety, depression, among other things, right? Addictions, etc. In your experience, how can the Enneagram help people who are wrestling with issues of mental health?
Yeah. So here's how it helps. So often I think people, they come in, you know, to my office and they're looking for a solution, right? As if there is one particular answer that's going to unlock, right, and get to the root of the problem, so to speak, whatever that problem is or difficulty. And what I love about the Enneagram is what it does is it allows a person to have better insight and awareness into the multitudes that exist within them. Mm. Like as I believe it was Richard Rohr who said, and I think it was on your podcast, he talked about, you know, or this could be your language, forgive me if it's yours and not his, but this idea that the Enneagram is sort of best understood as a lens by which to understand one's soul. And so not even necessarily as a, hey, so like I'm a two and that means like that's my identity, like that's who right. I am. What the two helps me do, what these numbers help people do is notice all the nuances within themselves. And so once they begin to notice all the nuances within themselves, then that gives us a vehicle, right, to move into the various situations that are going on in their lives and to understand and to get rid of this sort of myth that you're going to come in and find the one thing that we're going to push that and boom, everything's going to be better. To me, what I like about the Enneagram is that it's realistic about the complexities of these issues with mental health. You know, it's rarely ever one thing, like you were even saying right. a moment ago when you were so beautifully talking about medication as being the Eucharist, you know, or acting as the Eucharist, you know, it is an aid. But this medical model that we've seemed to kind of wholly bought into, and I'm not against the medical model, it's just too reductionistic right. by its very nature. You know, for some people, yes, maybe they're experiencing, you know, they've got major depressive disorder and we do the antidepressant and we do see a significant reduction in symptoms and they pretty much can then function at the level that they want to. That does happen for some people. For most people, it doesn't. We truly have to take in a more holistic approach right. where we're looking at the biology, the environment, right, their relationships, their spirituality, what they do for fun. And what I like is that the Enneagram says, look, we're not going to try and make this really simple and just and reduce this down to something that we can fix in 3 to 5 sessions and with this amount of medication. It says, no, you are a very complicated person and you have a lot of needs, a lot of desires, and you are a person that is also, not only do you have sort of a fixed identity, but you are also in constant change.
Yes.
So, right. And so, and everyone that you're in relationship is also a person that's in constant change. Mm-hmm. And so we have to have an awareness as best we can of those multitudes. And that's then where we get into not only actually dealing with the mental health issues that arrive, but that's how we thrive and how we come alive and live lives that are worth living, get into that abundant life that's promised to us, you know, by Jesus himself in scripture.
So, I mean, this is so powerful. I often will confuse people when I say, you know, you're not your Enneagram type, right? You are not a two. You are not a four. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Your personality, whether you like it or not, is a set of adaptive stratagems that you adopted as a small person. Yes, temperament and disposition have something to do with it, but it is a set of unconscious adaptive stratagems that you came up with to navigate the world of relationships and to cope with real primary trauma, right? And the truth of the matter is, when you over-identify your identity with your personality, you are actually in trouble because you are not your personality. There is behind your personality, and we would say essence, but I would say essential self. Mm-hmm. The self that was there before the world got its hands on you, right? That yearns to emerge, but first we got to deconstruct the games of this personality so that we can begin to, find touch again with the essence of who we truly are, which through a Christian lens would be a child of God. And realizing too, as you said, that your personality is not fixed. It's not a fixed set of traits because human beings are not things, they're processes.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And so, when you're doing your own personal work, you remember you're also a moving target.
Right. And let's be honest about that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, let's be honest with it. So when I say you're not your type, people look at me like, well, wait a minute, you're saying I'm a 7. No, I'm saying you're not a 7. You're not a 7. What we just uncovered is what you think is who you are, but yeah. It's not.
Oh, man, it's so good, so good. And that is really helpful, too, to understand when you say that human beings like are not things, we are processes. When you get people that are really in a deep, dark, depressive state, which I know you understand because you've been there, right? One of the worst parts about it, or we know we're getting into real trouble, when we begin to not have the ability to construct a future, because the pain mm-hmm. itself feels as though it is static. It's not right. going away.
Yep.
Where I'm at today is where I'm going to be tomorrow. Probably tomorrow is actually going to, in fact, be worse. And then it's only going to get worse from there, which is then we really get into the dangerous places. But if we can slow that thinking down and help people understand that they are not a thing, that they are a process, right? Then that allows for us to actually put hope into play, where hope is not just this sort of ephemeral, like there's hope, but we can use hope as the axe of like, if you are changing, right, then that truly leaves possibilities that you think perhaps are not possible, right? For chapters that you think cannot be written. Well, if you're in constant change, then we're admitting like it ain't going to be the same tomorrow. So that sometimes all we need is that little kind of divot to get inside there to start to fight back against this lie that the depression is always going to be there. It's never going to look any different. And the only way out of this is unconsciousness.
That is so good. Ryan, one of the things I've been working with lately, and as a therapist myself, not only thinking through, okay, well, I do think that each type, and again, I don't like to use labels too much. I know that that's unhelpful, diagnostic labels, but I do think each type has particular tendencies toward different mental health struggles, and which is helpful to know whether you are that type or you're happening to be in relationship with that type, right? So, for example, let's face it, there are among, let's say, twos, codependency, twos and nines, codependency would not be an unusual sort of issue that's happening in their lives, or this addiction to relationships, finding either self-esteem or merging with another personality, right? Another person for the nine. Threes, sometimes threes and sevens, narcissistic tendencies, right? Mm-hmm. For fours, issues around abandonment is almost universal for fours. Depression, very often seen in fours and in fives, but for very different reasons. Fives have sort of a natural tendency, I think, at times to sort of teeter on the edge of nihilism, right? They it's like that's why they're at the bottom of the Enneagram. Between the five and the four, that gap is often called the void because fours and fives can both fall into that. So fives wrestle with depression for different reasons than fours do. It's because they get to the end of their intellect and think to themselves, everything's meaningless. Mm. Everything has, you know, they're the ones who read too much Nietzsche and fall through the cracks. You know? Yeah. Right. And so then, you know, sixes, obviously anxiety, right? Generalized anxiety. Sevens, narcissism as well. Some narcissistic features, right? Eights, sort of oppositional, right? Behaviors. Yeah. And nines, more dependent personality issues. And I've oftentimes found the Enneagram helpful, not determinative, but helpful. You know, if someone with a particular type comes in, I can sort of go, yeah, you know, you're probably a five. I mean, there's sort of isolation and, you know, fair features of your type that could lead to mental health issues. And so just to know what they are, has that been your experience as well or not?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's very helpful to, you know, it's very helpful if someone knows their type. Right? Yes. And then you can get a sense of whether or not they've applied that to try and, you know, do some sort of like self-examination. But I've had so many instances that's really kind of sped up the work that I've done with people when they've done Enneagram work and you ask them about it. This happened recently to me where, you know, a guy was explaining to me his kind of entire childhood was a mystery to him. The dynamic that was going on between his mother and father and his brother. And it turns out, of course, to make a long story short, there was trauma that was not, or there was abuse, right? That was not disclosed. Nobody knew about it or whatever. And then there was the kind of major fallout. But when he discovered the Enneagram, right, then he was able to go back and see it through that lens, and it helped him understand, and it helped him really already be on the road towards not only accepting what had happened, but being able to also forgive the people in his family for how they were, right? It opened up a real space for grace to be present. And so then in our work, it's like because of that, because he'd already discovered this tool and put it at work, it kind of puts the work that we're doing like on warp speed. And so it's one of those things too, like I can't help myself. I don't do it all the time, but a lot of times it's almost become part of my intake where it's like I want to know, like, have you done any work with the Enneagram? Do you know? And if they haven't, it's almost like one of those tools that's like, go try it out. It's never gonna hurt you. Right. It can only help, right? It might not hit everybody, but it's one of those deals that it's like, and I feel like there are very few things like this in the kind of therapeutic world where I can say, like, go try it. Like, it will do no harm. And it might, in fact, actually just really speed up what we're going to do.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's what I like about it. You know, I know some, you know, treatment centers now, which as part of their initial intake, in addition to, you know, there's a lot of other instruments that are used, but they use the Enneagram early on, because for them, as a treatment team, it's like it accelerates the knowledge of the client in a way that would take them maybe a month, 30 days, 90 days, 60 days into treatment to realize the constellation of things going on.
Absolutely.
Beneath the surface. Then they can really get down to helping the person. And the person now has a language to talk about.
Right.
Right. As long as you got to keep telling them, this isn't the whole of it.
Right.
Just a piece of it. It's a good conversation starter, this Enneagram, but it's not the, you know, the magical mystery decoder of your interior landscape. It's just a, you know, one flashlight among many, kind of figuring out what's going on in there, you know.
It's a tool. But can I say something?
Sure.
Part of where it helped me too was understanding that my, you know, great sin or weakness or whatever we want to call it as a two is pride.
Yes.
And so for other twos, if there are other twos listening, what kept me initially from like when I first discovered the Enneagram, and I discovered it through you. I mean, it was with you, the popularity of your book, and I read it and enjoyed it. But I resisted this notion, because I always resist this notion of someone categorizing me. The way that I heard the Enneagram being spoken about, it was that like you are a three, like you are a two, like you are a five. And so, you know, anytime you're reading about it, it's like, well, you know, some of this seems to apply, but some of this doesn't. And I don't want this to like, sort of like, you know, maybe I'm too unique for this, right? I can't, maybe this can help all these other people, but not quite me, because I can't be wholly defined. See, That was just my misunderstanding of what it is. And so if like you have that reaction to it, I want people to really hear what it is we're saying here, is that we're not saying it's the sum all, you know, the be all. It's just a lens, and it's one piece, albeit a very, very powerful one, but no one is attempting to sum up your identity and your existence by one of these numbers. And so I had to get, you know, beyond that and help understand that. But it was my pride, I think, that really kept me from allowing it to do its work on me.
Yes, yes. In your own personal journey of healing, of recovery from, you know, issues of around mental health, and also just personal, the longing for completeness, right? I mean, that's a word I like. I think in some ways, I tend to sort of think about the human condition less in the language of sin and more in the language of incompleteness.
Mm.
You know, that we wrestle with a sense of, you know, and then we come up with all kinds of strategies to cope with the dis-ease that arises in a world in which you feel incomplete.
Yeah.
So how has the Enneagram been helpful to you? Like just on your own personal journey, forget about your practice. What about you?
Yeah, for me, you know, it helps me. I just want to be loved for who I am,
mm-hmm.
not for what I can provide or what kind of song and dance I can perform or what kind of peace I can keep among, the people. And that's going to constantly be, you know, a battle and a journey for me. Because I was that middle child who gained some self-worth by being the child who didn't cause any problems, who got his homework done, made the teacher proud, all of those sorts of things. And for me, as the older that I get, truly having experienced that kind of death to the first half of my life, I feel fortunate that I think that happened a little earlier maybe for me than for a lot of folks, although kind of mid-30s is about, you know, where it breaks down for a lot of people. But my journey is just to try and be as authentic as I can and allow myself to be seen and loved for that. And the big way that the Enneagram is helping me with that is that I have a lot of difficulty stating my own needs,
mm-hmm.
because I feel like if I express my needs, then I'm somehow less of that person that is providing a service to other people.
Mm-hmm.
And the more that I open up about it, right, and here's where I can specifically see it. My wife and I, she's okay with me saying this, right? We've been doing marriage therapy now for a few years together. We did individual work for a long time, but then never thought to get together and do it.
Right.
And so we've been doing that. And about 6 months ago, we were in a particularly kind of difficult spot with something. And the therapist looked at me and she said, Ryan, what is it that you need, you know, right now? And that's a question, right, that I ask the clients every day of my life, right, professionally. And when she asked me that, I knew like deep down what it was that I needed. But we probably sat there in silence for the greater part of 5 minutes because I could not reach down into my chest and pull it out and externalize the need. And even when I started to do it, the way that it was coming out was so clumsy and kind of half-baked and not really honest. I was trying to make it sound better than it was because I just still didn't want to just show myself. I didn't want to say, like, this is what I actually need. And I understand that maybe that makes me look less attractive or less successful or whatever it is, but here's what I need. And so my journey is, in my own personal life, showing up every day, desperately trying to put those needs on display when appropriate, and knowing that I am a child of God and that that's okay. And the people who love me are going to love me even more. And I'm going to be more at peace if I can express my needs and not just keep that down and try to be the good, shiny kind of kid. It's just, that's my personal journey right now. Mm.
Well, Ryan, you're describing the journey I hope all twos take, right? Because I think that part of the journey for the two is overcoming the fear of being unloved, of being unworthy of relationship, and this deep desire. This just it's so simple for twos. It's just this desire to be liked.
Yeah,
you know, man. It's pretty simple. I just want to be liked, but the strategy, the unhealthy strategy, is calculated giving. You know, it's this kind of this sort of manipulative giving. I'll take care of you if you'll take care of me without my needing to ask you to do it. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And then also to do what you just said, which is to express, well, to identify, and then to express personal needs, despite the anxiety that you might possibly be rejected and humiliated for even having personal needs.
Right. That's exactly right.
Yeah. So that's the journey I hope all twos take. Go ahead.
No, yeah. I was going to say, that's the real fear there, because I want to be liked and I want to be loved so much that I think that if I minimize my needs, or in fact, if I can just somehow exist without them, then that's going to increase my odds, right, of being loved and being accepted, especially if I have no needs, but I'm always attending to your needs, then that's going to put me in this really great spot. But what it ends up doing, I've noticed the same thing in my marriage. It happened like with the church. I end up resenting my wife because I look at her and I cannot believe that she doesn't know what I need, and that she hasn't come to try and pay attention to my needs in the way that I have with her. But I have not given her a chance, not a chance in hell at possibly even knowing what those are, because I'm not brave enough to talk about them.
Right. Wow, that's all good stuff right
that's
there,
really
man.
Ridiculous.
Ooh, that was juicy, wasn't it? We got a lot of juice in that
answer. I got some chill bumps on that one. A lot of good passion in there, too.
Yeah, man, there was.
I guess you can tell I struggle here, man. Even like right now as we're saying this, I'm thinking of the things that like I know need to be said. Mm-hmm. And I know that if I don't, I end up suffering. I'm going to suffer more. So you're just keeping yourself. Again, I find that, you know, we keep ourselves trapped. We want this abundant life, but it's our own fear, right? We're the only ones holding us back from walking into it.
Yes. And you're describing, you mentioned that, you know, kind of at the midpoint of life, oftentimes our self made stories about who we are and how we think the world works begin to explode. They aren't working, right? But the problem is, rather than face the pain, lots of types on the Enneagram just double down on the strategies of their type, right? And until they finally really tank, right?
Yeah.
Until they really exhaust it. Right. And if you can help people recognize the shadow side of their type on the strategy they're doubling down on, and the very fact that it's actually going to prevent them from getting what they want versus get what they want, you know, until that moment comes, it's pretty hard to get people to jump out of things like depression, anxiety, marriages falling apart, jobs tank, you know, the list goes on.
Yeah.
You know, just a sense of discontent with their lives, as Carl Jung would say, feeling like they're walking around in shoes that pinch, they're too small.
You know? Gosh, that's good.
Yeah, that their that's shoes better. Are pinching. Well, everybody, listen to me. I want you to check out Ryan Casey Waller's book, Depression, Anxiety, and Other Things We Don't want to talk about on his socials, Ryan Casey Waller, that's W-A-L-L-E-R on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Ryan, we are so glad you are on the show today. We love it, too, when we have male twos on the show. Mm-hmm. I don't know why it is it's so hard for us to get male twos. We've had a couple, but it's they're harder to find sometimes, aren't they?
Which is great when they show up.
They're great when they show up, especially when they show up as self-aware as Ryan has showed up, right? Well, hey, we like and approve of you, if that's any help.
It's so embarrassing to admit how much I want to hear you say that.
Well, that's we can validate you all day long, man, but unfortunately, we got to hop off. You got to hop off. You got clients that are waiting, I'm sure. And thank you so much for coming on Typology. And again, everybody, check out this new book of Ryan's. I think you're going to find it incredibly helpful for depression, anxiety, and other things we don't want to talk about. Mm. Anthony?
Yes, sir.
With you, there's nothing I don't want to talk about.
Feel the same about you.
And I want to give to you and to all of our listeners these words. May you have love. May you have joy. May you have peace. May you have healing. May you have rest. We'll talk to you next time.